distrust. People will start to lose interest. Eventually, you may find it worthwhile to commit to one side, if only for appearance's sake, to prove you are capable of attachment. Even then, however, the key will be to maintain your inner independence, to keep yourself from getting emotionally involved. Preserve the unspoken option of being able to leave at any moment and reclaim your freedom if the side you are allied with starts to collapse. The friends you made while you were being courted will give you plenty of places to go once you jump ship. Here are some further reflections on this law. From an Indian fable, The Kites, the Crows, and the Fox. The kites and the crows made an agreement among themselves that they should go halves in everything obtained in the forest. One day they saw a fox that had been wounded by hunters lying helpless under a tree and gathered round it. The crow said, "We will take the upper half of the fox." "Then we will take the lower half," said the kites. The fox laughed at this and said, "I always thought the kites were superior in creation to the crows. As such, they must get the upper half of my body, of which my head, with the brain and other delicate things in it, forms a portion."
"Oh, yes, that is right," said the kites. "We will have that part of the fox."
"Not at all," said the crows. "We must have it, as already agreed."
Then a war arose between the rival parties, and a great many fell on both sides, and the remaining few escaped with difficulty. The fox continued there for some days, leisurely feeding on the dead kites and crows, and then left the place hale and hearty, observing, "The weak benefit by the quarrels of the mighty." From Baltasar Gracian. Men of great abilities are slow to act, for it is easier to avoid occasions for committing yourself than to come well out of a commitment. Such occasions test your judgment. It is safer to avoid them than to emerge victorious from them. One obligation leads to a greater one, and you come very near to the brink of disaster. From A Fable by Leo Tolstoy. The Eagle and the Sow. An eagle built a nest on a tree and hatched out some eaglets, and a wild sow brought her litter under the tree. The eagle used to fly off after her prey and bring it back to her young, and the sow rooted around the tree and hunted in the woods, and when night came she would bring her young something to eat. And the eagle and the sow lived in neighborly fashion. And a grimalkin laid her plans to destroy the eaglets and the little sucking pigs. She went to the eagle and said, "Eagle, you had better not fly very far away. Beware of the sow. She is planning an evil design. She is going to undermine the roots of the tree. You see, she is rooting all the time." Then the grimalkin went to the sow and said, "Sow, you have not a good neighbor. Last evening I heard the eagle saying to her eaglets, 'My dear little eaglets, I'm going to treat you to a nice little pig. Just as soon as the sow is gone, I will bring you a little young sucking pig.'" From that time the eagle ceased to fly out after prey, and the sow did not go any more into the forest. The eaglets and the young pigs perished of starvation, and the grimalkin feasted on them. From A Treasury of Jewish Folklore. The Price of Envy. While a poor woman stood in the marketplace selling cheeses, a cat came along and carried off a cheese. A dog saw the pilferer and tried to take the cheese away from him. The cat stood up to the dog, so they pitched into each other. The dog barked and snapped. The cat spat and scratched, but they could bring the battle to no decision.
"Let's go to the fox and have him referee the matter," the cat finally suggested.
"Agreed," said the dog.
So they went to the fox. The fox listened to their arguments with a judicious air.
"Foolish animals," he chided them. "Why carry on like that? If both of you are willing, I'll divide the cheese in two and you'll both be satisfied."
"Agreed," said the cat and the dog.
So the fox took out his knife and cut the cheese in two. But instead of cutting it lengthwise, he cut it in the width.
"My half is smaller," protested the dog.
The fox looked judiciously through his spectacles at the dog's share.
"You're right, quite right," he decided.
So he went and bit off a piece of the cat's share.
"That will make it even," he said.
When the cat saw what the fox did, she began to yowl.
"Just look! My part's smaller now."
The fox again put on his spectacles and looked judiciously at the cat's share.
"Right you are," said the fox. "Just a moment, and I'll make it right."
And he went and bit off a piece from the dog's cheese. This went on so long, with the fox nibbling first at the dog's and then at the cat's share, that he finally ate up the whole cheese before their eyes. The 21st Law. Play a sucker to catch a sucker. Seem dumber than your mark. Judgment. No one likes feeling stupider than the next person. The trick, then, is to make your victims feel smart. And not just smart, but smarter than you are. Once convinced of this, they will never suspect that you may have ulterior motives. Observance of the Law. In the winter of 1872, the U.S. financier Asbury Harpending was visiting London when he received a cable. A diamond mine had been discovered in the American West. The cable came from a reliable source, William Ralston, owner of the Bank of California. But Harpending nevertheless took it as a practical joke, probably inspired by the recent discovery of huge diamond mines in South Africa. True, when reports had first come in of gold being discovered in the western United States, everyone had been skeptical, and those had turned out to be true. But a diamond mine in the West? Harpending showed the cable to his fellow financier, Baron Rothschild, one of the richest men in the world, saying it must be a joke. The Baron, however, replied, "Don't be too sure about that. America is a very large country. It has furnished the world with many surprises already. Perhaps it has others in store." Harpending promptly took the first ship back to the States. When Harpending reached San Francisco, there was an excitement in the air recalling the gold rush days of the late 1840s. Two crusty prospectors named Philip Arnold and John Slack had been the ones to find the diamond mine. They had not divulged its location, in Wyoming, but had led a highly respected mining expert to it several weeks back, taking a circular route so he couldn't guess his whereabouts. Once there, the expert had watched as the miners dug up diamonds. Back in San Francisco, the expert had taken the gems to various jewelers, one of whom had estimated their worth at $1.5 million. Harpending and Ralston now asked Arnold and Slack to accompany them back to New York, where the jeweler Charles Tiffany would verify the original estimates. The prospectors responded uneasily. They smelled a trap. How could they trust these city slickers? What if Tiffany and the financiers managed to steal the whole mine out from under them? Ralston tried to allay their fears by giving them $100,000 and placing another $300,000 in escrow for them. If the deal went through, they would be paid an additional $300,000. The miners agreed. The little group traveled to New York, where a meeting was held at the mansion of Samuel L. Barlow. The cream of the city's aristocracy was in attendance. General George Brinton McClellan, commander of the Union forces in the Civil War. General Benjamin Butler. Horace Greeley, editor of the newspaper The New York Tribune. Harpending, Ralston, and Tiffany. Only Slack and Arnold were missing. As tourists in the city, they had decided to go sightseeing. When Tiffany announced that the gems were real and worth a fortune, the financiers could barely control their excitement. They wired Rothschild and other tycoons to tell them about the diamond mine and inviting them to share in the investment. At the same time, they also told the prospectors that they wanted one more test. They insisted that a mining expert of their choosing accompany Slack and Arnold to the site to verify its wealth. The prospectors reluctantly agreed. In the meantime, they said, they had to return to San Francisco. The jewels that Tiffany had examined, they left with Harpending for safekeeping. Several weeks later, a man named Louis Janin, the best mining expert in the country, met the prospectors in San Francisco. Janin was a born skeptic, who was determined to make sure that the mine was not a fraud. Accompanying Jannan were Harpending and several other interested financiers. As with the previous experiment, the prospectors led the team through a complex series of canyons, completely confusing them as to their whereabouts. Arriving at the site, the financiers watched in amazement as Jannan dug the area up, leveling anthills, turning over boulders, and finding emeralds, rubies, sapphires, and most of all, diamonds. The dig lasted 8 days, and by the end, Jannan was convinced. He told the investors that they now possessed the richest field in mining history. "With 100 men and proper machinery," he told them, "I would guarantee to send out $1 million in diamonds every 30 days. Returning to San Francisco a few days later, Ralston, Harpending, and company acted fast to form a $10 million corporation of private investors. First, however, they had to get rid of Arnold and Slack. That meant hiding their excitement. They certainly didn't want to reveal the field's real value. So they played possum. "Who knows if Jannan is right?" they told the prospectors. "The mine may not be as rich as we think." This just made the prospectors angry. Trying a different tactic, the financiers told the two men that if they insisted on having shares in the mine, they would end up being fleeced by the unscrupulous tycoons and investors who would run the corporation. Better, they said, to take the $700,000 already offered, an enormous sum at the time, and put their greed aside. This the prospectors seemed to understand, and they finally agreed to take the money, in return signing the rights to the site over to the financiers and leaving maps to it. News of the mine spread like wildfire. Prospectors fanned out across Wyoming. Meanwhile, Harpending and group began spending the millions they had collected from their investors, buying equipment, hiring the best men in the business, and furnishing luxurious offices in New York and San Francisco. A few weeks later, on their first trip back to the site, they learned the hard truth. Not a single diamond or ruby was to be found. It was all a fake. They were ruined. Harpending had unwittingly lured the richest men in the world into the biggest scam of the century. Interpretation. Arnold and Slack pulled off their stupendous con, not by using a fake engineer or bribing Tiffany. All the experts had been real. All of them honestly believed in the existence of the mine and in the value of the gems. What had fooled them all was nothing else than Arnold and Slack themselves. The two men seemed to be such rubes, such hayseeds, so naive, that no one for an instant had believed them capable of such an audacious scam. The prospectors had simply observed the law of appearing more stupid than the mark, the deceiver's first commandment. The logistics of the con were quite simple. Months before Arnold and Slack announced the discovery of the diamond mine, they traveled to Europe, where they purchased some real gems for around $12,000, part of the money they had saved from their days as gold miners. Then they salted the mine with these gems, which the first expert dug up and brought to San Francisco. The jewelers who had appraised these stones, including Tiffany himself, had gotten caught up in the fever and had grossly overestimated their value. Then Ralston gave the prospectors $100,000 as security, and immediately after their trip to New York, they simply went to Amsterdam, where they bought sacks of uncut gems before returning to San Francisco. The second time they salted the mine, there were many more jewels to be found. The effectiveness of the scheme, however, rested not on tricks like these, but on the fact that Arnold and Slack played their parts to perfection. On their trip to New York, where they mingled with millionaires and tycoons, they played up their clodhopper image, wearing pants and coats a size or two too small, and acting incredulous at everything they saw in the big city. No one believed that these country simpletons could possibly be conning the most devious, unscrupulous financiers of the time. And once Harpending, Ralston, and even Rothschild accepted the mine's existence, anyone who doubted it was questioning the intelligence of the world's most successful businessmen. In the end, Harpending's reputation was ruined, and he never recovered. Rothschild learned his lesson and never fell for another con. Slack took his money and disappeared from view, never to be found. Arnold simply went home to Kentucky. After all, his sale of his mining rights had been legitimate. The buyers had taken the best advice, and if the mine had run out of diamonds, that was their problem. Arnold used the money to greatly enlarge his farm and open up a bank of his own. Keys to Power. The feeling that someone else is more intelligent than we are is almost intolerable. We usually try to justify it in different ways. He only has book knowledge, whereas I have real knowledge. Her parents paid for her to get a good education. If my parents had had as much money, if I had been as privileged... He's not as smart as he thinks. Last but not least, she may know her narrow little field better than I do, but beyond that, she's really not smart at all. Even Einstein was a boob outside physics. Given how important the idea of intelligence is to most people's vanity, it is critical never inadvertently to insult or impugn a person's brain power. That is an unforgivable sin. But if you can make this iron rule work for you, it opens up all sorts of avenues of deception. Subliminally reassure people that they are more intelligent than you are, or even that you are a bit of a moron, and you can run rings around them. The feeling of intellectual superiority you give them will disarm their suspicion muscles. In 1865, the Prussian counselor Otto von Bismarck wanted Austria to sign a certain treaty. The treaty was totally in the interests of Prussia and against the interests of Austria, and Bismarck would have to strategize to get the Austrians to agree to it. But the Austrian negotiator, Count Blum, was an avid card player. His particular game was Cannes, and he often said that he could judge a man's character by the way he played Cannes. Bismarck knew of this saying of Blum's. The night before the negotiations were to begin, Bismarck innocently engaged Blum in a game of Cannes. The Prussian would later write, "That was the very last time I ever played Cannes. I played so recklessly that everyone was astonished. I lost several thousand thalers, the currency of the time, but I succeeded in fooling Blum, for he believed me to be more venturesome than I am, and I gave way." Besides appearing reckless, Bismarck also played the witless fool, saying ridiculous things and bumbling about with a surplus of nervous energy. All this made Blum feel he had gathered valuable information. He knew that Bismarck was aggressive. The Prussian already had that reputation, and the way he played had confirmed it. An aggressive man, Blum knew, can be foolish and rash. Accordingly, when the time came to sign the treaty, Blum thought he had the advantage. A heedless fool like Bismarck, he thought, is incapable of cold-blooded calculation and deception. So he only glanced at the treaty before signing it. He failed to read the fine print. As soon as the ink was dry, a joyous Bismarck exclaimed in his face, "Well, I could never have believed that I should find an Austrian diplomat willing to sign that document." The Chinese have a phrase, "masquerading as a swine to kill the tiger." This refers to an ancient hunting technique in which the hunter clothes himself in the hide and snout of a pig and mimics its grunting. The mighty tiger thinks a pig is coming his way and lets it get close, savoring the prospect of an easy meal. But it is the hunter who has the last laugh. Masquerading as a swine works wonders on those who, like tigers, are arrogant and overconfident. The easier they think it is to prey on you, the more easily you can turn the tables. This trick is also useful if you are ambitious, yet find yourself low in the hierarchy. Appearing less intelligent than you are, even a bit of a fool, is the perfect disguise. Look like a harmless pig, and no one will believe you harbor dangerous ambitions. They may even promote you, since you seem so likable and subservient. Claudius, before he became emperor of Rome, and the Prince of France, who later became Louis XIII, used this tactic when those above them suspected they might have designs on the throne. By playing the fool as young men, they were left alone. When the time came for them to strike and to act with vigor and decisiveness, they caught everyone off guard. Intelligence is the obvious quality to downplay. But why stop there? Taste and sophistication rank close to intelligence on the vanity scale.
Make people feel they are more sophisticated than you are, and their guard will come down. As Arnold and Slack knew, an air of complete naivete can work wonders. Those fancy financiers were laughing at them behind their backs, but who laughed loudest in the end? In general, then, always make people believe they are smarter and more sophisticated than you are. They will keep you around because you make them feel better about themselves. And the longer you are around, the more opportunities you will have to deceive them. Reversal. To reveal the true nature of your intelligence rarely pays. You should get in the habit of downplaying it at all times. If people inadvertently learn the truth, that you are actually much smarter than you look, they will admire you more for being discreet than for making your brilliant show. At the start of your climb to the top, of course, you cannot play too stupid. You may want to let your bosses know, in a subtle way, that you are smarter than the competition around you. As you climb the ladder, however, you should to some degree try to dampen your brilliance. There is, however, one situation where it pays to do the opposite. When you can cover up a deception with a show of intelligence. In matters of smarts, as in most things, appearances are what count. If you seem to have authority and knowledge, people will believe what you say. This can be very useful in getting you out of a scrape. The art dealer Joseph Duveen was once attending a soiree at the New York home of a tycoon to whom he had recently sold a Durer painting for a high price. Among the guests was a young French art critic, who seemed extremely knowledgeable and confident. Wanting to impress this man, the tycoon's daughter showed him the Durer, which had not yet been hung. The critic studied it for a time, then finally said, "You know, I don't think this Durer is right." He followed the young woman as she hurried to tell her father what he had said, and listened as the magnate, deeply unsettled, turned to Duveen for reassurance. Duveen just laughed. "How very amusing," he said. "Do you realize, young man, that at least 20 other art experts here and in Europe have been taken in, too? Have said that painting isn't genuine. And now you've made the same mistake." His confident tone and air of authority intimidated the Frenchman, who apologized for his mistake. Duveen knew that the art market was flooded with fakes, and that many paintings had been falsely ascribed to old masters. He tried his best to distinguish the real from the fake, but in his zeal to sell, he often overlooked a work's authenticity. What mattered to him was that the buyer believed he had bought a Durer, and that Duveen himself convinced everyone of his expertness through his air of irreproachable authority. Thus, it is important to be able to play the professor when necessary, and never impose such an attitude for its own sake. Here is a further reflection on this law. From Arthur Schopenhauer. "Now there is nothing of which a man is prouder than of intellectual ability, for it is this that gives him his commanding place in the animal world. It is an exceedingly rash thing to let anyone see that you are decidedly superior to him in this respect, and to let other people see it too. Hence, while rank and riches may always reckon upon deferential treatment in society, that is something which intellectual ability can never expect. To be ignored is the greatest favor shown to it, and if people notice it at all, it is because they regard it as a piece of impertinence, or else as something to which its possessor has no legitimate right, and upon which he dares to pride himself. And in retaliation and revenge for his conduct, people secretly try and humiliate him in some other way. And if they wait to do this, it is only for a fitting opportunity. A man may be as humble as possible in his demeanor, and yet hardly ever get people to overlook his crime in standing intellectually above them." In The Garden of Roses, Southey makes the remark, "You should know that foolish people are 100-fold more averse to meeting with wise than the wise are indisposed for the company of the foolish." On the other hand, it is a real recommendation to be stupid. For just as warmth is agreeable to the body, so it does the mind good to feel its superiority. And a man will seek company likely to give him this feeling as instinctively as he will approach the fireplace, or walk in the sun if he wants to get warm. But this means that he will be disliked on account of his superiority. And if a man is to be liked,
He must really be inferior in point of intellect. The 22nd Law. Use the surrender tactic. Transform weakness into power. Judgment. When you are weaker, never fight for honor's sake. Choose surrender instead. Surrender gives you time to recover. Time to torment and irritate your conqueror. Time to wait for his power to wane. Do not give him the satisfaction of fighting and defeating you. Surrender first. By turning the other cheek, you infuriate and unsettle him. Make surrender a tool of power. Transgression of the Law. The island of Melos is strategically situated in the heart of the Mediterranean. In classical times, the city of Athens dominated the sea and coastal areas around Greece. But Sparta, in the Peloponnese, had been Melos's original colonizer. During the Peloponnesian War, then, the Melians refused to ally themselves with Athens and remained loyal to Mother Sparta. In 416 BC, the Athenians sent an expedition against Melos. Before launching an all-out attack, however, they dispatched a delegation to persuade the Melians to surrender and become an ally rather than suffer devastation and defeat. "You know as well as we do," the delegate said, "that the standard of justice depends on the equality of power to compel, and that, in fact, the strong do what they have the power to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept." When the Melians responded that this denied the notion of fair play, the Athenians said that those in power determined what was fair and what was not. The Melians argued that this authority belonged to the gods, not to mortals. "Our opinion of the gods and our knowledge of men," replied a member of the Athenian delegation, "lead us to conclude that it is a general and necessary law of nature to rule whatever one can." The Melians would not budge. Sparta, they insisted, would come to their defense. The Athenians countered that the Spartans were a conservative, practical people and would not help Melos, because they had nothing to gain and a lot to lose by doing so. Finally, the Melians began to talk of honor and the principle of resisting brute force. "Do not be led astray by a false sense of honor," said the Athenians. "Honor often brings men to ruin when they are faced with an obvious danger that somehow affects their pride. There is nothing disgraceful in giving way to the greatest city in Hellas when she is offering you such reasonable terms." The debate ended. The Melians discussed the issue among themselves and decided to trust in the aid of the Spartans, the will of the gods, and the rightness of their cause. They politely declined the Athenians' offer. A few days later, the Athenians invaded Melos. The Melians fought nobly, even without the Spartans, who did not come to their rescue. It took several attempts before the Athenians could surround and besiege their main city. But the Melians finally surrendered. The Athenians wasted no time. They put to death all the men of military age that they could capture. They sold the women and children as slaves, and they repopulated the island with their own colonists. Only a handful of Melians survived. Interpretation. The Athenians were one of the most eminently practical people in history, and they made the most practical argument they could with the Melians. When you are weaker, there is nothing to be gained by fighting a useless fight. No one comes to help the weak. By doing so, they would only put themselves in jeopardy. The weak are alone and must submit. Fighting gives you nothing to gain but martyrdom, and in the process, a lot of people who do not believe in your cause will die. Weakness is no sin, and can even become a strength if you learn how to play it right. Had the Melians surrendered in the first place, they would have been able to sabotage the Athenians in subtle ways, or might have gotten what they could have out of the alliance, and then left it when the Athenians themselves were weakened, as in fact happened several years later. Fortunes change, and the mighty are often brought down. Surrender conceals great power. Lulling the enemy into complacency, it gives you time to recoup, time to undermine, time for revenge. Never sacrifice that time in exchange for honor in a battle that you cannot win. As Cardinal de Retz said, "Weak people never give way when they ought to." observance of the law. Sometime in the 1920s, the German writer Bertolt Brecht became a convert to the cause of communism. From then on, his plays, essays, and poems reflected his revolutionary fervor, and he generally tried to make his ideological statements as clear as possible. When Hitler came to power in Germany, Brecht and his communist colleagues became marked men. He had many friends in the United States, Americans who sympathized with his beliefs, as well as fellow German intellectuals who had fled Hitler. In 1941, accordingly, Brecht emigrated to the United States and chose to settle in Los Angeles, where he hoped to make a living in the film business. Over the next few years, Brecht wrote screenplays with a pointedly anti-capitalist slant. He had little success in Hollywood, so in 1947, the war having ended, he decided to return to Europe. That same year, however, the U.S. Congress's House Un-American Activities Committee began its investigation into supposed communist infiltration in Hollywood. It began to gather information on Brecht, who had so openly espoused Marxism. And on September 19, 1947, only a month before he had planned to leave the United States, he received a subpoena to appear before the committee. In addition to Brecht, a number of other writers, producers, and directors were summoned to appear as well. And this group came to be known as the Hollywood 19. Before going to Washington, the Hollywood 19 met to decide on a plan of action. Their approach would be confrontational. Instead of answering questions about their membership or lack of it in the Communist Party, they would read prepared statements that would challenge the authority of the committee and argue that its activities were unconstitutional. Even if this strategy meant imprisonment, it would gain publicity for their cause. Brecht disagreed. What good was it, he asked, to play the martyr and gain a little public sympathy, if in the process they lost the ability to stage their plays and sell their scripts for years to come? He felt certain they were all more intelligent than the members of the committee. Why lower themselves to the level of their opponents by arguing with them? Why not outfox the committee by appearing to surrender to it while subtly mocking it? The Hollywood 19 listened to Brecht politely, but decided to stick to their plan, leaving Brecht to go his own way. The committee finally summoned Brecht on October 30th. They expected him to do what others among the Hollywood 19 who had testified before him had done: argue, refuse to answer questions, challenge the committee's right to hold its hearing, even yell and hurl insults. Much to their surprise, however, Brecht was the very picture of congeniality. He wore a suit, something he rarely did, smoked a cigar. He had heard that the committee chairman was a passionate cigar smoker, answered their questions politely, and generally deferred to their authority. Unlike the other witnesses, Brecht answered the question of whether he belonged to the Communist Party. He was not a member, he said, which happened to be the truth. One committee member asked him, "Is it true you have written a number of revolutionary plays?" Brecht had written many plays with overt communist messages, but he responded, "I have written a number of poems and songs and plays in the fight against Hitler, and, of course, they can be considered, therefore, as revolutionary, because I, of course, was for the overthrow of that government." The statement went unchallenged. Brecht's English was more than adequate, but he used an interpreter throughout his testimony, a tactic that allowed him to play subtle games with language. When committee members found communist leanings in lines from English editions of his poems, he would repeat the lines in German for the interpreter, who would then retranslate them, and somehow they would come out innocuous. At one point, a committee member read one of Brecht's revolutionary poems out loud in English and asked him if he had written it. "No," he responded, "I wrote a German poem, which is very different from this." The author's elusive answers baffled the committee members, but his politeness and the way he yielded to their authority made it impossible for them to get angry with him. After only an hour of questioning, the committee members had had enough. "Thank you very much," said the chairman. "You are a good example to the other witnesses." Not only did they free him, they offered to help him if he had any trouble with immigration officials who might detain him for their own reasons. The following day, Brecht left the United States, never to return. Interpretation. The Hollywood 19's confrontational approach won them a lot of sympathy, and years later they gained a kind of vindication in public opinion. But they were also blacklisted and lost valuable years of profitable working time. Brecht, on the other hand, expressed his disgust for the committee more indirectly. It was not that he changed his beliefs or compromised his values. Instead, during his short testimony, he kept the upper hand by appearing to yield while all the time running circles around the committee with vague responses, outright lies that went unchallenged because they were wrapped in enigmas, and word games. In the end, he kept the freedom to continue his revolutionary writing, as opposed to suffering imprisonment or detainment in the United States, even while subtly mocking the committee and its authority with his pseudo-obedience. Keep in mind the following. People trying to make a show of their authority are easily deceived by the surrender tactic. Your outward sign of submission makes them feel important. Satisfied that you respect them, they become easier targets for a later counterattack, or for the kind of indirect ridicule used by Brecht. Measuring your power over time, never sacrifice long-term maneuverability for the short-lived glories of martyrdom. From an Ethiopian proverb, "When the great lord passes, the wise peasant bows deeply and silently farts." Keys to Power. What gets us into trouble in the realm of power is often our own overreaction to the moves of our enemies and rivals. That overreaction creates problems we would have avoided had we been more reasonable. It also has an endless rebound effect, for the enemy then overreacts as well, much as the Athenians did to the Melians. It is always our first instinct to react, to meet aggression with some other kind of aggression. But the next time someone pushes you and you find yourself starting to react, try this. Do not resist or fight back, but yield. Turn the other cheek. Bend. You will find that this often neutralizes their behavior. They expected, even wanted you, to react with force, and so they are caught off guard and confounded by your lack of resistance. By yielding, you in fact control the situation, because your surrender is part of a larger plan to lull them into believing they have defeated you. This is the essence of the surrender tactic. Inwardly you stay firm, but outwardly you bend. Deprived of a reason to get angry, your opponents will often be bewildered instead. And they are unlikely to react with more violence, which would demand a reaction from you. Instead, you are allowed the time and space to plot the counter moves that will bring them down. In the battle of the intelligent against the brutal and the aggressive, the surrender tactic is the supreme weapon. It does require self-control. Those who genuinely surrender give up their freedom and may be crushed by the humiliation of their defeat. You have to remember that you only appear to surrender, like the animal that plays dead to save his hide. We have seen that it can be better to surrender than to fight. Faced with a more powerful opponent and a sure defeat, it is often also better to surrender than to run away. Running away may save you for the time being, but the aggressor will eventually catch up with you. If you surrender instead, you have an opportunity to coil around your enemy and strike with your fangs from close up. In 473 BC, in ancient China, King Gojian of Yue suffered a horrible defeat from the ruler of Wu in the Battle of Fuzhou. Gojian wanted to flee, but he had an advisor who told him to surrender and place himself in the service of the ruler of Wu, from which position he could study the man and plot his revenge. Deciding to follow this advice, Gojian gave the ruler all of his riches and went to work in his conqueror's stables as the lowest servant. For 3 years he humbled himself before the ruler, who then, finally satisfied of his loyalty, allowed him to return home. Inwardly, however, Gojian had spent those 3 years gathering information and plotting revenge. When a terrible drought struck Wu and the kingdom was weakened by inner turmoil, he raised an army, invaded, and won with ease. That is the power behind surrender. It gives you the time and the flexibility to plot a devastating counterblow. Had Gojian run away, he would have lost this chance. When foreign trade began to threaten Japanese independence in the mid-19th century, the Japanese debated how to defeat the foreigners. One minister, Hota Masayoshi, wrote a memorandum in 1857 that influenced Japanese policy for years to come. I am therefore convinced that our policy should be to conclude friendly alliances, to send ships to foreign countries, everywhere, and conduct trade, to copy the foreigners where they are at their best, and so repair our own shortcomings, to foster our national strength and complete our armaments, and so gradually subject the foreigners to our influence, until in the end all the countries of the world know the blessings of perfect tranquility, and our hegemony is acknowledged throughout the globe. This is a brilliant application of the law. Use surrender to gain access to your enemy. Learn his ways. Insinuate yourself with him slowly. Outwardly conform to his customs, but inwardly maintain your own culture. Eventually you will emerge victorious. For while he considers you weak and inferior and takes no precautions against you, you are using the time to catch up and surpass him. This soft, permeable form of invasion is often the best, for the enemy has nothing to react against, prepare for, or resist. And had Japan resisted Western influence by force, it might well have suffered a devastating invasion that would have permanently altered its culture. Surrender can also offer a way of mocking your enemies, of turning your power against them, as it did for Brecht. Milan Kundera's novel, The Joke, based on the author's experiences in a penal camp in Czechoslovakia, tells the story of how the prison guards organized a relay race, guards against prisoners. For the guards, this was a chance to show off their physical superiority. The prisoners knew they were expected to lose, so they went out of their way to oblige, miming exaggerated exertion while barely moving, running a few yards and collapsing, limping, jogging ever so slowly while the guards raced ahead at full speed. Both by joining the race and by losing it, they had obliged the guards obediently. But their over-obedience had mocked the event to the point of ruining it. Over-obedience, surrender, was here a way to demonstrate superiority in a reverse manner. Resistance would have engaged the prisoners in the cycle of violence, lowering them to the guards' level. Over-obeying the guards, however, made them ridiculous. Yet they could not rightly punish the prisoners who had only done what they asked. Power is always in flux. Since the game is by nature fluid and an arena of constant struggle, those with power almost always find themselves eventually on the downward swing. If you find yourself temporarily weakened, the surrender tactic is perfect for raising yourself up again. It disguises your ambition. It teaches you patience and self-control, key skills in the game, and it puts you in the best possible position for taking advantage of your oppressor's sudden slide. If you run away or fight back, in the long run you cannot win. If you surrender, you will almost always emerge victorious. Reversal. The point of surrendering is to save your hide for a later date when you can reassert yourself. It is precisely to avoid martyrdom that one surrenders. But there are times when the enemy will not relent, and martyrdom seems the only way out. Furthermore, if you are willing to die, others may gain power and inspiration from your example. Yet martyrdom, surrender's reversal, is a messy, inexact tactic, and is as violent as the aggression it combats. For every famous martyr, there are thousands more who have inspired neither a religion nor a rebellion. So that if martyrdom does sometimes grant a certain power, it does so unpredictably. More important, you will not be around to enjoy that power, such as it is. And there is finally something selfish and arrogant about martyrs, as if they felt their followers were less important than their own glory. When power deserts you, it is best to ignore this law's reversal. Leave martyrdom alone. The pendulum will swing back your way eventually, and you should stay alive to see it. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Leonardo da Vinci, The Chestnut and the Fig Tree. A man who had climbed upon a certain fig tree was bending the boughs toward him and plucking the ripe fruit, which he then put into his mouth to destroy and gnaw with his hard teeth. The chestnut, seeing this, tossed its long branches and with tumultuous rustle exclaimed, "O fig! How much less protected by nature you are than I! See how my sweet offspring are set in close array, first clothed in soft wrappers, over which is the hard but softly lined husk. And not content with this much care, nature has also given us these sharp and close-set spines, so that the hand of man cannot hurt us." Then the fig tree began to laugh, and after the laughter it said, "You know well that man is of such ingenuity that he will bereave even you of your children. But in your case he will do it by means of rods and stones, and when they are felled he will trample them with his feet or hit them with stones, so that your offspring will emerge from their armor crushed and maimed, while I am touched carefully by his hands, and never, like you, with roughness." And from the Little Brown Book of Anecdotes. Voltaire was living in exile in London at a time when anti-French sentiment was at its highest. One day, walking through the street, he found himself surrounded by an angry crowd. "Hang him! Hang the Frenchman!" they yelled. Voltaire calmly addressed the mob with the following words. "Men of England, you wish to kill me because I am a Frenchman? Am I not punished enough in not being born an Englishman?" The crowd cheered his thoughtful words and escorted him safely back to his lodgings. The 23rd Law. Concentrate your forces. Judgment. Conserve your forces and energies by keeping them concentrated at their strongest point. You gain more by finding a rich mine and mining it deeper than by flitting from one shallow mine to another. Intensity defeats extensity every time. When looking for sources of power to elevate you, find the one key patron, the fat cow who will give you milk for a long time to come. Transgression of the Law. In China in the early 6th century B.C., the Kingdom of Wu began a war with the neighboring northern provinces of the Middle Kingdom. Wu was a growing power, but it lacked the great history and civilization of the Middle Kingdom, for centuries the center of Chinese culture. By defeating the Middle Kingdom, the King of Wu would instantly raise his status. The war began with great fanfare and several victories, but it soon bogged down. A victory on one front would leave the Wu armies vulnerable on another. The king's chief minister and advisor, Wu Zhaoshu, warned him that the barbarous state of Yue to the south was beginning to notice the kingdom of Wu's problems and had designs to invade. The king only laughed at such worries. One more big victory and the great Middle Kingdom would be his. In the year 490, Wu Zhaoshu sent his son away to safety in the kingdom of Qi. In doing so, he sent the king a signal that he disapproved of the war, and that he believed the king's selfish ambition was leading Wu to ruin. The king, sensing betrayal, lashed out at his minister, accusing him of a lack of loyalty, and, in a fit of anger, ordered him to kill himself. Wu Zhaoshu obeyed his king, but before he plunged the knife into his chest, he cried, "Tear out my eyes, O king, and fix them on the gate of Wu, so that I may see the triumphant entry of the Yue." As Wu Zhaoshu had predicted, within a few years a Yue army passed beneath the gate of Wu. As the barbarians surrounded the palace, the king remembered his minister's last words, and felt the dead man's disembodied eyes watching his disgrace. Unable to bear his shame, the king killed himself, covering his face, so that he would not have to meet the reproachful gaze of his minister in the next world. Interpretation. The story of Wu is a paradigm of all the empires that have come to ruin by overreaching. Drunk with success and sick with ambition, such empires expand to grotesque proportions and meet a ruin that is total. That is what happened to ancient Athens, which lusted for the faraway island of Sicily and ended up losing its empire. The Romans stretched the boundaries of their empire to encompass vast territories. In doing so, they increased their vulnerability and the chances of invasion from yet another barbarian tribe. Their useless expansion led their empire into oblivion. For the Chinese, the fate of the Kingdom of Wu serves as an elemental lesson on what happens when you dissipate your forces on several fronts, losing sight of distant dangers for the sake of present gain. "If you are not in danger," says Sun Tzu, "do not fight." It is almost a physical law. What is bloated beyond its proportions inevitably collapses. The mind must not wander from goal to goal, or be distracted by success from its sense of purpose and proportion. What is concentrated, coherent, and connected to its past has power. What is dissipated, divided, and distended rots and falls to the ground. The bigger it bloats, the harder it falls. Observance of the law. The Rothschild banking family had humble beginnings in the Jewish ghetto of Frankfurt, Germany. The city's harsh laws made it impossible for Jews to mingle outside the ghetto. But the Jews had turned this into a virtue. It made them self-reliant and zealous to preserve their culture at all costs. Meyer Amschel, the first of the Rothschilds to accumulate wealth by lending money in the late 18th century, well understood the power that comes from this kind of concentration and cohesion. First, Meyer Amschel allied himself with one family, the powerful princes of Thurn und Taxis. Instead of spreading his services out, he made himself these princes' primary banker. Second, he entrusted none of his business to outsiders, using only his children and close relatives. The more unified and tight-knit the family, the more powerful it would become. Soon Meyer Amschel's five sons were running the business. And when Meyer Amschel lay dying in 1812, he refused to name a principal heir, instead setting up all of his sons to continue the family tradition, so that they would stay united and would resist the dangers of diffusion and of infiltration by outsiders. Once Meyer Amschel's sons controlled the family business, they decided that the key to wealth on a larger scale was to secure a foothold in the finances of Europe as a whole, rather than being tied to any one country or prince. Of the five brothers, Nathan had already opened up shop in London. In 1813, James moved to Paris. Amschel remained in Frankfurt. Solomon established himself in Vienna, and Karl, the youngest son, went to Naples. With each sphere of influence covered, they could tighten their hold on Europe's financial markets. This widespread network, of course, opened the Rothschilds to the very danger of which their father had warned them. Diffusion, division, dissension. They avoided this danger and established themselves as the most powerful force in European finance and politics by once again resorting to the strategy of the ghetto, excluding outsiders, concentrating their forces. The Rothschilds established the fastest courier system in Europe, allowing them to get news of events before all their competitors. They held a virtual monopoly on information. And their internal communications and correspondence were written in Frankfurt Yiddish, and in a code that only the brothers could decipher. There was no point in stealing this information. No one could understand it. "Even the shrewdest bankers cannot find their way through the Rothschild maze," admitted a financier who had tried to infiltrate the clan. In 1824, James Rothschild decided it was time to get married. This presented a problem for the Rothschilds, since it meant incorporating an outsider into the Rothschild clan, an outsider who could betray its secrets. James therefore decided to marry within the family, and chose the daughter of his brother Solomon. The brothers were ecstatic. This was the perfect solution to their marriage problem. James's choice now became the family policy. 2 years later, Nathan married off his daughter to Solomon's son. In the years to come, the five brothers arranged 18 matches among their children, 16 of these being contracted between first cousins. "We are like the mechanism of a watch. Each part is essential," said Brother Solomon. As in a watch, every part of the business moved in concert with every other, and the inner workings were invisible to the world, which only saw the movement of the hands. While other rich and powerful families suffered irrecoverable downturns during the tumultuous first half of the 19th century, The tight-knit Rothschilds managed not only to preserve, but to expand their unprecedented wealth. Interpretation. The Rothschilds were born in strange times. They came from a place that had not changed in centuries, but lived in an age that gave birth to the Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution, and an endless series of upheavals. The Rothschilds kept the past alive, resisted the patterns of dispersion of their era, and for this are emblematic of the law of concentration. No one represents this better than James Rothschild, the son who established himself in Paris. In his lifetime, James witnessed the defeat of Napoleon, the restoration of the Bourbon monarchy, the bourgeois monarchy of Orléans, the return to a republic, and finally the enthronement of Napoleon III. French styles and fashions changed at a relentless pace during all this turmoil. Without appearing to be a relic of the past, James steered his family as if the ghetto lived on within them. He kept alive his clan's inner cohesion and strength. Only through such an anchoring in the past was the family able to thrive amidst such chaos. Concentration was the foundation of the Rothschilds' power, wealth, and stability. As Karl von Clausewitz said in On War, "The best strategy is always to be very strong, first in general, then at a decisive point. There is no higher or simpler law of strategy than that of keeping one's forces concentrated. In short, the first principle is, act with the utmost concentration." Keys to Power. The world is plagued by greater and greater division. Within countries, political groups, families, even individuals. We are all in a state of total distraction and diffusion, hardly able to keep our minds in one direction before we are pulled in 1,000 others. The modern world's level of conflict is higher than ever, and we have internalized it in our own lives. The solution is a form of retreat inside ourselves, to the past, to more concentrated forms of thought and action. As Schopenhauer wrote, "Intellect is a magnitude of intensity, not a magnitude of extensity." Napoleon knew the value of concentrating your forces at the enemy's weakest spot. It was the secret of his success on the battlefield. But his willpower and his mind were equally modeled on this notion. Single-mindedness of purpose, total concentration on the goal, and the use of these qualities against people less focused, people in a state of distraction, such an arrow will find its mark every time and overwhelm the enemy. Casanova attributed his success in life to his ability to concentrate on a single goal and push at it until it yielded. It was his ability to give himself over completely to the woman he desired that made him so intensely seductive. For the weeks or months that one of these women lived in his orbit, he thought of no one else. When he was imprisoned in the treacherous Leads of the Doge's palace in Venice, a prison from which no one had ever escaped, he concentrated his mind on the single goal of escape day after day. A change of cells, which meant that months of digging had all been for naught, did not discourage him. He persisted and eventually escaped. "I have always believed," he later wrote, "that when a man gets it into his head to do something, and when he exclusively occupies himself in that design, he must succeed whatever the difficulties. That man will become Grand Vizier or Pope." Concentrate on a single goal, a single task, and beat it into submission. In the world of power, you will constantly need help from other people, usually those more powerful than you. The fool flits from one person to another, believing that he will survive by spreading himself out. It is a corollary of the law of concentration, however, that much energy is saved and more power is attained by affixing yourself to a single, appropriate source of power. The scientist Nikola Tesla ruined himself by believing that he somehow maintained his independence by not having to serve a single master. He even turned down J.P. Morgan, who offered him a rich contract. In the end, Tesla's independence meant that he could depend on no single patron, but was always having to toady up to a dozen of them. Later in his life, he realized his mistake. All the great Renaissance painters and writers wrestled with this problem. None more so than the 16th century writer Pietro Aretino, Throughout his life, Aretino suffered the indignities of having to please this prince and that. At last he had had enough, and decided to woo Charles V, promising the emperor the services of his powerful pen.